Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. We're about two-thirds through the year-long celebration of St. Louis's 250th anniversary. From the fur trading days to the Great Divorce, from the World's Fair to the building of the Arch, it's been a colorful history with a lot that has set St. Louis apart from the rest. The years have been chronicled in a detailed, heavily illustrated coffee table book titled Historic St. Louis, 250 Years of Exploring New Frontiers. Authored by University of Missouri St. Louis History Professor Fred Faust, it includes lots of text and lots of pictures and photographs. I'm Don Marsh. Fred Faust, who is also the author of Founding St. Louis, First City of the New West, joins me in studio to talk about the latest book and the history it documents. Fred, so nice to see you again.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Enjoyed the book. It's a very, very pretty book and a very, very detailed book, as I've indicated.
Thanks a lot.
And it's the right year for it, isn't it?
It won't sell much next year.
Fred, you know, I have to wonder and did wonder going through the book if St. Louis lived up to its early potential. What do you think? There's so much was going on 100, 150 years ago, and here we are today. What do you think?
Well, I certainly think it lived up to its potential for took two centuries. And the point I like to make is going back to Pierre Laclede's quote, as Auguste Chouteau claimed he made, he wanted to build one of the finest cities in America, not one of the biggest, but one of the finest. So, you know, if we quit wringing our hands about the huge population loss in the last several decades and determine that what is valuable and good about this city, you know, the half full, half empty question always comes to mind. I like to think of St. Louis as kind of an empty nester house with a ample room, extra, mm-hmm. extra room. And there's so much going on here. I think the vibrancy of the city, the spirit of the city is still here, even if you have to include, you know, 90 other communities, because, you know, we created a metro area, and it is a truly vibrant city as the founders envisioned.
And one of the things that's interesting to notice today is, number one, the number of immigrants who have come to this city. I'm thinking primarily of the Bosnians, but also the fact that the city has recognized that it wants to attract more people from other countries.
Absolutely.
Here because of their entrepreneurial spirit. So you kind of get the feeling that there is a new momentum maybe taking place.
I think so. The Bosnian miracle, in fact, in terms of the number of people, the quality of the community, and the opportunities they've grasped, and that's revealing to people that were born here, people that have been fifth generation St. Louisans, and energy, you know, is what cities generally focus on, and the energy comes from entrepreneurs, the energy comes from explorers, and that's why exploration was the theme of this new book. We take it for granted that Pierre Laclede came and founded a city, and really it was a city from the beginning. It wasn't a trade post. It wasn't an outpost because it was large scale. And any fur trade of the kind that brought in hundreds of thousands of pounds of furs within the first couple of years had to be a city filled with workers of all kinds, boatmen, hunters, and so forth.
Well, it was early on, but certainly during the middle of the 19th century, a city of immigrants.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yes. When you realize that St. Louis went from 14,000 people, ranked 44th largest city in the country in 1830, to sixth largest at 78,000 people just by 1850, and 40,000 of those were German or Irish. And then we had a large number of truly global population from every corner of the earth at the time of the World's Fair.
Why did they come here in the middle of the 19th century? A lot of them came and stayed. They didn't join the progression west.
Right, right. Well, as Neil Prim said, it was a city in motion, people in, people out. The Germans, of course, had recruitment efforts in their native land. The Irish, pre- and post-famine, saw opportunities here. You know, with the United States kind of divided by the Mississippi River, this was truly the first city on the West Bank, and it was the most western of eastern city, and later became the most eastern of western cities as L.A. and San Francisco and Denver came along. So opportunity.
I've heard it said, and you can corroborate this, I'm sure, or dispute it, that during the middle of the 19th century, there were more immigrants in St. Louis than there were in New York City.
I'm not sure. You know, that probably if it's early enough, if it's 1850 or so, that could really be true. Obviously, New York and the East Coast got a huge increase in immigration in the later 19th mm-hmm. century. But I haven't actually not heard that, so I can't verify it one way or the other.
Well, you've heard it now. Okay. Just remember your source.
I'll
when you quote. Anyway, I read that somewhere along the line. It's a good story. There were certainly a lot of them here. You mentioned the Germans. Another thing that I have heard, and I've heard it from many different sources, is one of the things that was attractive to the Germans was that this area reminded them so much of Germany, with the rivers. And, of course, you go a little bit west to Hermann, wine country, that sort of thing.
Yes, if you look at the eastern half of Missouri, that's certainly the case. For a while, the farming Germans out there in what we call the wine country today outnumbered the Germans in the city. And it wasn't too late. As early as the 1830s and 1840s, when the Germans came, they planned. They had a schedule of what to bring, how much money to have on them. The Germans that preceded them told them, you know, how to fit in. Well, when they got here, the shock was the high cost of housing. So that's how Belleville got to have so many Germans. People lived on the Illinois side to save money.
Right. Belleville, coincidentally, celebrating its 200th anniversary this year. I'd like to talk about that for a moment because it's a pretty big deal over in Belleville. I wonder if it's a bigger deal in Belleville than it is in St. Louis. I mean, it's our semi-quincentennial. We've got a bunch of cakes around town. And it seems like that's pretty much it. I expected more.
I did too, frankly. Mm-hmm. I think it was kicked off splendidly in the middle of February with the conference at the Missouri History Museum. And UMSL had an April conference where we celebrated St. Louis' birthday, 800th birthday, with historical papers and so forth. And along the way, there have been a lot of events sponsored by small and local historical societies. I expected more.
In a way, I guess I'll get in trouble for saying this. In a way, it seems to me, kind of St. Louis, kind of pump everything up and get it ready to go and then, you know,
It's definitely hard to sustain over the course of a year. Now, remember, the bicentennial, a celebration like no other, you know, was from 1964 to 1966. Mm-hmm. So they stretched it out. But they had the advantage of, in that period, the arch opening, the new Bush Stadium, and a World Series win and all kinds of things going on. Visit by President Lyndon Johnson in February 1964. And so many projects up and running or soon to begin. And it usually involved destruction and construction in terms of remaking the downtown. So there was definitely an energy there. And part of it is the fact that people look at even-numbered years like a bicentennial and kind of forget the 250th. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have any celebration for the centennial. It was during the Civil War. But people were celebrating everything soon after the World's Fair. They wanted to keep that momentum going. So 1904 World's Fair, 1909, the 200th anniversary of the incorporation of St. Louis as a town, not a city, but a town. And then 1914, the big mask and pageant were about 500,000 citizens came out to see their neighbors perform.
You have a wonderful picture in there. I believe in Forest Park in 1914. I mean, it looked like it was absolutely wild.
It was jam-packed. Yeah. 8,000 actors or you know, not all speaking parts, of course, but 8,000 people performed.
What were they performing?
Well, they had two dramas commissioned. One was called A Mask, and one was called A Pageant. And they were different authors and a different focus. But to sum up, they were looking at the chronicle of time, going back to Cahokia. And then when they went through all the stages of St. Louis history, they looked at the future and they said, where are we headed? And being the progressive era, they basically said, let's do away with the gold and the emphasis on wealth and build a better community. Brother and brother moving forward. Unfortunately, none of the brothers were black. Mm-hmm. They didn't have speaking parts. They didn't appear on the program. And so despite the onset of the Great Migration from the South, African Americans were largely ignored.
Excluded from the process, which is a familiar story on many different fronts.
Just real quickly, people say, well, that enthusiasm for all those actors and the musical spectacle and so forth was the origins of the Muni. And it's interesting to note that the first black was admitted to the audience of a Muni in 1954, and the first black dancer performed in 1962. So there were a lot of decades where race relations weren't improving whatsoever.
And my bet is that those performers in the 50s and the 60s weren't able to stay in the local hotels. They had to stay with friends.
Probably not. Yeah, that's right.
Right. I want to get into more of that after we take a break. But very quickly, you alluded to the 1964, the bicentennial. What was the situation there with regard to inclusion of the African Americans?
Not too much better, you know.
It was right before the really push in the civil rights movement.
We had the major corporate leaders, sponsors and organizers and so forth. And while National Geographic ran a big piece on, you know, the celebration, blacks weren't really a part of it.
And, of course, the veiled prophet situation was very, very strong. The organization was very strong at that time. And people still point today to the fact that the veiled prophet wore a costume that was very much like the KKK.
That's right.
Right.
Indeed.
That didn't help the situation.
Oh,
very
sure
much.
Didn't.
Fred Faust is our guest. He's the author of Historic St. Louis, 250 Years of Exploring New Frontiers. It's his latest book, and it's one, obviously, that's decided in which it was decided to come out for the 250th anniversary of the city of St. Louis. What a coincidence, as we say. We'll come back and continue our conversation. If you'd like to get into it, feel free to do so at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Send us a tweet at STL on air if you like. Back in a moment with Fred in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation with Fred Faust, author of Historic St. Louis, 250 Years of Exploring New Frontiers. The book is just out, and of course it helps commemorate the 250th anniversary of the city of St. Louis, the founding of St. Louis, which we are observing this year. But before we continue our conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. City officials, including Mayor Francis Slay and Police Chief Sam Dotson, today asked for the public's help in solving gun crimes in St. Louis. There have been 97 homicides so far this year. Dotson and Slay say that police are seeing resistance from witnesses coming forward. A fire has destroyed one of two memorials at the site where 18-year-old Michael Brown was killed by a police officer in Ferguson. Ferguson police spokesman Devin James says the cause of the fire is under investigation. And representatives of Great Rivers Greenway and TrailNet will announce today that the third phase of the region's bike routes will be completed by next spring. It will include 40 new miles of bike routes and upgrades to 60 miles of existing routes in the city of St. Louis's streets. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Fred Faust. Fred, the news headlines reflect this, but obviously the biggest story of the day in St. Louis continues to be the aftermath of the shooting of Michael Brown. I'm wondering if you see anything in our history and where you can connect the dots between what's happening today in a situation like this and these homicides that we're talking about and our history. Do you see any connection?
Nothing would be helpful. Frankly, you know, you see a pattern of discrimination, a pattern of remaining separate. Ironically, the best time in one sense for race relations, including living next door to one another in close contact, was the 18th century. Mm-hmm. And obviously, as a city expands, a city has a greater population, you see an increase of prejudice and discrimination after every large influx of African Americans. Mm-hmm. And after the Civil War, it worked well enough because they were passing through. The Exodusters were going to Kansas to farm. But, you know, for a city that was Lincoln's city on the Mississippi, the only Southern city to vote for Lincoln in a majority, St. Louis did a lot during the Civil War to create schools, to help the refugee blacks that were coming from out of state. And then by the end of the 19th and early 20th century, you have total reversal.
Why? Do we know? Can we pinpoint something that caused that to happen?
Well, you probably didn't have open arms in terms of welcoming blacks to many neighborhoods. And then when the neighborhood was set as predominantly white or predominantly black, and you have an influx of blacks, you don't have any chance. Mm-hmm. By statute, by realtor covenants. And, of course, in 1916, we had a referendum, the first time that the people were allowed to express their desire for new legislation, new ordinances, and so forth. And it was 52,000 for segregation and about 17,000 for integration. So, you know, that's the citizens speaking. And that's hard. It's not impossible, but it's certainly hard to counteract.
And it took another 42 years for Shelley versus Kramer to go before the Supreme Court and eliminate those restrictive covenants.
Yeah, and only partially to some extent, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, in the 60s and 70s, you had places like Blackjack trying to keep blacks out and by, you know, creative means and ultimately illegal means.
And right after the period you're talking about, 1916, I think it was 1917, that the race riots in East St. Louis took place. Of course, that's not part of our story, yet it is, because a lot of the people from East St. Louis fled across the river to come here to escape the carnage that was going on.
That's right. And by and large, St. Louis gets decent marks for providing shelter and welcome of some type for some of those people.
It's been a troubled history. There's no question
with regard
to race relations. Much work still to be done, clearly. We have a couple of calls. I have lots I want to talk about,
okay.
But let's get the audience into it. We'll start with Tom calling from Afton. Tom, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Don. You know, you're talking about the race relations in St. Louis and the Delmar Divide and all that, and it seems to me that we ought to focus on what I think is the proudest moment in St. Louis history, especially for those of us with the German last names, which is what they call the Missouri Putsch, when the St. Louis Germans marched on the governor and overthrew the governor before the Civil War to make sure that Missouri didn't join the Confederacy. And what I went to ask Professor is, growing up with the German last name, all I knew about Germans was the two world wars, and I was embarrassed. But when I learned about the Missouri Putsch, I thought, you know, that was my forebears. My forebears did something that I feel really proud of. And I wish the rest of St. Louis, I feel like we're still embarrassed about being German because we identify Germans with the world wars and the Holocaust, but our forebears were kind of in the opposite direction with the Missouri Putsch. Does as a historian, do you see that people being still embarrassed about their German background?
I see more positive elements with regard to the research my students do with Germans over many generations and sensitive treatment of how Germans were treated during the World Wars. But, you know, we wouldn't have had the sympathy for the Union and positive votes for Lincoln if it hadn't been for the strong German element of freedom fighters who emigrated and lived here and created schools and scientific societies and so forth. That plus the Yankee industrialists made St. Louis probably the most liberal city along the Mississippi River in the late 1850s through the late 1860s. So certainly the Germans in St. Louis have much to be proud of.
Tom, thanks for the call. You know, they did bring an extraordinarily liberal tone to the to this part of the country at that particular time. And that's not something you might necessarily attribute to Germans. And yet it was very, very true at
those
this
Germans,
time and
yeah.
at those They're, Germans.
That's right.
I wonder why. Do you have any sense of why they...
Well, they had unfulfilled desires to overthrow the monarchy and to establish a liberal democracy. And if they couldn't do it there, St. Louis was a great testing ground. It was just about the right size, enough going on, a good economy, and let's try this out, you know.
We have another question, I think, relating to the German population. Robert joins us from St. Louis. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment following up on that, that those 48ers that came over after the failed democratic revolutions in Prussia were very much the intelligentsia of their society. And one of the very bright spots in St. Louis history is the fact that the St. Louis public schools in the two decades following the Civil War were regarded as the best public school system in the country. You had, under the direction of William Torrey Harris, and then, you know, probably familiar with the first kindergarten with Susan Blow. But also with the St. Louis Philosophical Society, you were just hitting on a number of these societies that started out. There was a very intimate connection between the St. Louis Philosophical Society, which was started by Henry Brockmeyer, who was a German immigrant, later went on to be lieutenant governor, and William Torrey Harris. And the work they did in speculative philosophy came to have a real profound impact on the public school system in St. Louis. In St. Louis in the two decades following the Civil War. That was just my comment.
No, a very good comment. The Hegelian movement here, and, you know, it really was tied in with some of the intellectuals that came from other areas of the Northeast. So this really was a hotbed of progressivism long before the country adopted that terminology. If you look at the growth after the Civil War, some of that liberality was joined by a commercial explosion. In 1890, St. Louis had 37 newspapers. They had 106 public schools. Intrigues me is the humane movement to support a large variety of public facilities. They cared for orphans, the poor, the blind, the elderly, and the insane in 47 different asylums by 1890, plus two female night refuges for abused or abandoned women.
Wow.
That's progressive.
Yeah, I was going to say, progressive is exactly the word. And of those 30-plus newspapers, a good many of them were in German.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
Some of them were influential ones.
A couple of other German names that come to mind are Anheuser and Busch come to mind.
That's right.
Certainly made their mark. And I guess part of that whole dynasty, the beginning of it, was to satisfy the needs of the German population. They liked their beer.
Right. And they liked the site that the Clay picked because of the caves for lager aging beer. And there were some breweries that weren't founded by Germans, but most were.
How important was Anheuser-Busch to the city of St. Louis?
Well, I have to put him in the company of one or two other breweries, brewing dynasties. If one didn't think of a marketing tool, another one did. They both went to, like the Limp Brewery, went to refrigerated railroad cars too. But Anheuser-Busch was certainly prominent, and if they weren't first, they were the longest lasting and basically the ones that kept reinventing themselves.
It really seems to have put St. Louis on the map in many ways.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was one non-German wrote as early as in the 1840s that he couldn't go anywhere without speaking German. He couldn't buy clothing. Yeah. He couldn't get a beer. And the Germans held fast to their cultural traditions in the sense of that's what you did on a sunny Sunday afternoon. You went to a beer garden.
After 1917, or in the breakout of our part of the war, World War One, were Germans changing the pronunciation of their names as they were elsewhere? Were street names being changed, that sort of thing?
It didn't seem to be so pronounced, but I know it happened. And I grew up in the German river city of Covington, Kentucky, across from Cincinnati. So, you know, I had at least one grandfather that got in trouble for expressing his opinions. But, there were some name changing. There was some moving around.
I think it's Berlin, Ohio. It used to be called Berlin, but they changed the pronunciation to reflect. Make it sound not so German. Yeah.
But the spelling remained.
The spelling remained. Let's go back to the phones. Bring in Jerry calling from Baldwin. Jerry, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling about the term Khorasan. I heard in the news today that one of the organizations that we and our allies attacked in Syria, was it Syria or Libya? Today was called the
Syria.
Khorasan, and I recall Khorasan being associated with the VP organization, and also there was a room in the Chase Park Plaza, I believe, called the Khorasan Room. So I wonder about the connection between our Khorasan and their Khorasan.
I don't think it's spelled the same way. There is a Khorasan Room, of course, in the Chase, a very famous location. But the raid today in Syria, I believe it's spelled differently.
I believe so, sure too.
I connection there.
I haven't seen it in print. I just heard it on the radio. Yeah. But it seemed like is there an organization called the Knights of the Khorasan that's connected with the VP Fair organization?
There is something like that. I'd hate to go on the record, and I'm afraid I don't think you would either. Yeah, but
okay.
It's something. You know, Jerry, we'll all after this program. Look it up in Google, okay? The answer to all questions ultimately goes to Google. Thank you for the call. Let's bring in Lana. Lana calling from St. Louis. Go ahead.
Hi. For some reason, I have no idea where it came from. I have an original script of the pageant in Mosque of St. Louis in Forest Park in May 1914.
Wow.
And, yeah.
Is it a typescript or is it printed?
Text script.
Oh.
And it has, I just counted them, it has 56 named characters. But then along with that are Indians, mound builders, Spanish and French explorers, American soldiers, pioneers, farmers, immigrants. So that's why they needed all of those people on that stage.
That's great. Yeah. Wouldn't you love to have seen that?
Oh, gosh, and now we have the Shakespeare Festival in the park and the Muni, but this sounds like it was spectacular.
Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm.
Lana, you'll have to get a copy of Fred's book because there's a picture in there that really illustrates exactly what you're talking about. It was quite a mob scene and fascinating to look at.
Oh, I will get it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Where can folks get your book, Fred?
It's being sold at the Missouri History Museum gift shop. It's being sold at the UMSL campus bookstore at the Millennium Center. The number there is 516-5763 if anybody's interested. And I will be giving a PowerPoint presentation this coming Monday, the 29th, from 12:15 to 1:15. At 402 J.C. Penney Building about the different identities of St. Louis over its 250-year span, and the book will be sold, and I'll sign it at that time, 12:15 to 1:15 on Monday. And then closer to Christmas, the St. Louis Genealogical Society Book Jamboree, where my books and a host of the other local writers, Sunday the 23rd of November, contact the St. Louis Genealogical Society for more information on that. But it's a kind of book that I was worried that people to even know it was out. So the distribution network is a little different. It's right now it's not on Amazon, which thrills book dealers no end, bookstores, I should say. But it's kind of been introduced in dribbles, but it's widely available now.
It's a tough racket, this book publishing
and
selling. This is a hardback version we're talking about, but there, ultimately a softback version is going to be available as well.
Yes, that's right. I'll get the information out on that in due course.
Let's see. What else would we like to talk about with regard to some of our history? We've talked about the Germans. How about the Irish and the Italians? They played a pretty big role in our
formative years. Yes, indeed. It was several complex decades there when you had an influx of Germans and an influx of Irish. And the Irish had immigrants here who became leaders, like the Melanfi, wealthy and political clout. They didn't come directly from Ireland. They were here from, immigrated from another U.S. state. Then you had, the Italians coming in, especially on the Hill. They were celebrating Columbus Day long before it was picked up by Chicago in the 1893 World's Fair. Just a great diversity. And, of course, opposing virtually every immigrant group were the know-nothings, the nativists, the people that were born in America and resented the influx. So when you look at what people have described as the 155 French families, right? This was, we know it was predominantly French until the Louisiana Purchase. In 1780, 97% of the adult males came from a French region. And when you, including France itself, and when you see the influx of the Americans shortly before and certainly after the Louisiana Purchase, there was a conflict there, a cultural conflict involving language and religion and so forth. And then if you were neither French nor American coming directly from Europe, there were people in the majority population that were very resentful and even violent.
When did this nativist attitude kind of peter out, or did it?
I think it around the Civil War, if I would guess. I'm not sure anybody can be so precise, but it was more mid-century, and the Know-Nothing Party collapsed. Some of the Know-Nothing elements were absorbed by both the Democrats and the Republicans. And then when you had Irish and Germans fighting on both sides in the Civil War, other issues of differentiation took hold. You know, are you pro or anti-slavery?
There were so many immigrants here. Was there a point at which the number of immigrants outnumbered the number of Native Americans, if you will?
Not quite.
But close.
Yeah. It surged.
Right.
Yeah.
Have to take another break. My guest in studio is UMSL History Professor Fred Faust, author of Historic St. Louis, 250 Years of Exploring New Frontiers. We'll come back and continue our conversation. We have lines open. If you'd like to be a part of it, questions about our history, Fred's the guy to talk to. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK, or send us a tweet at SDL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation with Fred Faust, author of Historic St. Louis, 250 Years of Exploring New Frontiers. Fred, this was just brought to me. It says, on our Facebook page, we've asked our listeners about something you said earlier, that you expected more out of St. Louis's 250th anniversary. You remember saying that?
Yes, I did.
But we asked about that on Facebook, and Meg wrote, I expected them to do things all year round. Instead, we got a few things in the winter, and it seems like nothing else. If you are going to say it's a birthday celebration, then it needs to be all year, where people can find multiple things to help celebrate, in fact, in more than just Forest Park, which can be hard to get into, as some of us found out this past weekend during the balloon. You can tell us what you think. I'm addressing the audience now. Search for St. Louis Public Radio on Facebook or send us a tweet at STL on Air. So you're not alone in thinking.
That's good. Yeah. And I've been involved in several anniversaries. The probably the best one was the 350th anniversary of Maryland, and they had activities of all sorts, kind of more academically oriented, but also, you know, fun activities. And it didn't hurt that I was teaching at the original founding site, Colonial Maryland.
You know, you've been quoted as saying, and I think it may be in conjunction with a book, that you have concerns about young people's appreciation of history.
Yes, I do.
And recognizing that the past can be indeed prologue.
Yes, I certainly do. I keep thinking about the movement of STEM subjects, science and technology and engineering and math. And while that's very important, of course, I see it every day in terms of my college class members, and that history isn't being taught well at all. This is certainly a local concern. It's a national concern. And when you ignore history, the country suffers. It's more than just another subject in high school, no more than just another subject in college. You know, the old question about if a tree falls in the forest and there's no humans there, does it make a sound? Well, of course it doesn't, because sound is reflected in the human ear. History has to be remembered by humans. History has to be transmitted to other humans, or history will die. You know, it's unthinkable that at some point people might forget there was a Pearl Harbor or a D-Day. And as those veterans die out, I remember 1994, the 50th anniversary, President Clinton walked along the beach. He said, "I never knew what D-Day was all about." And it's incredible that the ignorance that's out there. And if you wanted a curriculum, you could just look at the life of Auguste Chouteau, who came here at 14 and lived a long life 65 years later. And he interacted with all kinds of nationalities, all kinds of Native Americans, and it was a man of commerce, or was a man of city planning and so forth. So if that doesn't excite 13- and 14-year-olds, I guess there's really nothing, unless you make it a video game.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I spoke to a young African-American woman yesterday who was very much involved in the situation in Ferguson, very much committed to civil rights and equality and fairness and all the rest of it. And the subject of sundown towns came up.
Yes.
And she had no idea what I was talking about, which is very sad, because that's such an important part of the history of African-Americans in this area. There was plenty of that going on, where blacks were excluded after sundown from being
right.
visible in town.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it's important. As they say, the past is prologue, and it's important to learn these things. I'm going to put one in your wheelhouse now. We have a tweet in which you are asked, "Please have your guests discuss the discovery of French settlements' remains on arch grounds and preservation efforts there."
Oh.
This is your specialty, that part of our history.
Yeah, the colonial part.
Yeah.
All the information hasn't been divulged, because the process of excavation and analysis continues. What I can say is that obviously we're concerned about security, about divulging the location of that one site, which isn't fully excavated yet. What it shows is that there was at least one fur trader. Certainly one would regard him as a minor fur trader. He lived in a house that was only 15 feet by 18 feet, but he had some very exquisite, some very expensive French pottery that obviously he was able to buy or trade for, because he was involved in the best business to be involved in, the fur trade. So if we know that there were, we know literally what was being brought down from Canada. A lot of people think the trade was totally with New Orleans, and it wasn't the case. What made St. Louis special was that they sent the fleet boats up to Montreal via Michilimackinac and brought down the wealth of the world, especially British goods for whites as well as Indians as well as blacks. And St. Louis was so prominent as an affluent consumer society that you had elite, well-educated Europeans flocking here in the 1780s and 1790s. disproving Thomas Jefferson's idea that the fur trade could never support a sophisticated, civilized society.
I have an email here from Corey. This is an interesting tidbit, as he mentions, relating to jazz history and German immigrants. St. Louis, very important city for jazz musicians, as we know, coming from New Orleans on the way to Chicago and New York, many of whom stayed here permanently. One interesting fact is that the city was most well-known in jazz history for its trumpeters, who had a very clean, clear sound that reflected the influence of the German brass band teachers here, who gave young trumpeters of St. Louis a strong technical foundation.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's a nice little
piece
terrific.
Of information. That's terrific. One of my grandfathers grew up in New Orleans, and it had a German element I didn't know about and still could learn a lot about.
It's and, of course, music is an integral part of this city's history. Let's go back to the phones. Carlotta will join us from Ferguson. Go ahead, Carlotta.
Hi. I'm of French heritage here in St. Louis, and I had heard, and it might even be Dr. Faust who had mentioned this in one of his books, that after the Louisiana Purchase and the acquisition or the transfer of St. Louis to the United States, that French heritage and traditions were deliberately sort of stymied or squelched in deference to more English or American customs. And I wonder if that's true or if you could elaborate on that.
It's absolutely true. Bob Moore of the National Park Service has stated it most strongly in terms of the deliberateness that the Americans that Jefferson called the new sovereigns of the country did to change the culture of the French. They tended to discount them because of the language barrier and the religious barrier and so forth. And the main thing was that it was Indian policy. It was irreconcilable differences between how the Anglo-American farmers operated and the French traders. Obviously, farmers, whether they're in Virginia, Kentucky, or here in Missouri, wanted the area cleared of Indians for their own safety. They wanted as much acreage as possible. The traders needed the Indians to be close. So how do you reconcile those two things? And it was well known that the Chouteaus and a number of the prominent French trading families had children by Indian women. And Thomas Jefferson, who it's been proven had children by a slave woman, didn't approve of what they called miscegenation. Because if you created Indian children, they were an obstacle. They were a potential danger in Jefferson's mind. Whereas if you fathered slave children, you know, it was part of the profits. And there are some really shocking quotes from Jefferson's own journal about how the main product of Monticello was selling black children. Selling black children is the way he described it.
Thank you so much for the call, Carlotta. I want to get Jeff into the conversation now, calling from Olivet. Go ahead, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. I know that the Jewish community in St. Louis was very much tied in with the German community for many years. That's why it's mostly Reform, and was wondering whether the professor has discussed this in the book at all.
I discussed the Philipson brothers that came from Philadelphia and set up probably the second oldest brewery in town, and they were very intellectual. This is early 19th century, before 1810 and 18-teens. They taught languages, several different languages. One collected classic art. They were musically inclined. They were quite an addition, three brothers who weren't French and they weren't, you know, Anglo-American. So it did indicate that St. Louis was open to a vast variety of people from different cultures.
Jeff, thanks for the call. While we're on the subject of religious influence, let's ask Harry, who is on a cell in Labadie, to come into the conversation. Go ahead, Harry.
Hi, Mr. Marsh and Professor. Thanks for taking my call. I grew up in a small German Catholic parish in Baden, not Baden, and it's separated from the
Harry, I'm afraid we're going to have to let that go. It's breaking up so badly. But I believe what he wanted to get to was the Catholic influence on school integration here, which is...
Absolutely.
Yeah, the big influence.
Yes. Bishop Ritter integrated the Catholic schools in 1947, 7 years before Brown versus Board of Education. And St. Louis University admitted the first black student, I think, in 52. Yes, absolutely. The parochial schools in the region set the standard for integration.
One thing I wanted to get to, and we have time to do that now, I believe, is the question that many people ask. We alluded earlier on to what the kind of a city St. Louis was 100 years ago. And you think of 1904, the World's Fair, and we had the Olympics here the same year. What the heck happened? Chicago somehow took over in the midst of all of this advanced, whatever you would call it, that we were going through at the time. How did Chicago beat out St. Louis?
Well, one of the reasons was that if we rebounded quickly from the Great Fire of 1849, Chicago rebounded extremely quickly from the fire in the early 1870s.
This is O'Leary's Cow Fire?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. That's right. And, you know, as the windy city that has nothing to do with breezes off Lake Michigan, but a boastful city full of itself, they certainly had the urban impetus to go for all the prizes they could in terms of securing the Olympic Games and so forth. But they expanded their boundaries tenfold over what we were able to do. So right before the World's Fair, Chicago grew in numbers and grew in acreage dramatically. And if we lost the Columbian Exposition to Chicago, we took the Olympics from them. They were supposed to get the Olympics in 1904, and we said, well, since we have the World's Fair, wouldn't it make more sense? And it was a real Olympics. The Paris Olympics wasn't that great, but St. Louis's was. And if I could be any place, I'd love to see some of the events, especially the six medals won by the gymnast with a wooden leg and the infamous marathon.
I thought the railroads had something to do with it.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's nothing we could have done. Geographically, Chicago was in just an ideal situation to connect to the northern cities, Erie Canal, the Great Lakes, the railroads west. They had a bridge across the Mississippi much earlier than the Eads Bridge. And frankly, the so-called Yankee capitalists that were here prior to the Civil War moved back to New York or moved north to Chicago and funded all of that. And because of slavery, because of St. Louis's perception as a southern city.
A little bit over a minute left. So did we let it slip away or did they take it from us?
Well, we have no apologies to make and no regrets. I mean, I think the 1904 worked so much better for us. And we were doing just fine with steamboats and railroads and the bridges and all the rest of it. It's just two different communities that matured in different ways. They had a lot more violence. They had a lot more immigrant violence and so forth, and we didn't. We had relatively peaceful labor relations, and when we did have strikes and so forth, it was violence against property, not people.
Well, you know, that may have been true then, but, you know, I go back to those headlines I read a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
97 homicides in the city of St. Louis already this year, and we've got a ways to go.
Yeah, and that can ruin everything.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what you build or what you promote.
As I think has been reflected, we've been called the most dangerous city a couple of times, and that's had an impact. People just don't want to move their businesses to cities that have a reputation like that. Okay, very, very quickly, where are you going to be on Monday? Remind folks
I'll be at UMSL in 402 J.C. Penney Building, 1215 to 115, giving a PowerPoint presentation and then signing and selling books afterwards.
Alrighty, that is Professor Fred Fouts, author of Historic St. Louis, 250 Years of Exploring New Frontiers. He's been our guest today and has been our guest in the past, and I hope will be our guest in the future. It's a great book. We've only scratched the surface in a very moderate way with regard to all the information that is in this very fine, handsome book. Fred, thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the relationship between the labor movement and the women's movement. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.